For this Tuesday, August the 11th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your headlines. The ticket is set. Biden-Harris, as the presumptive Democratic nominee, chooses his one-time rival, Senator Kamala Harris, as his running mate. That story is just ahead. On Capitol Hill, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell calling for the Trump administration and congressional Democrats to restart negotiations on a fifth coronavirus deal. This after talks collapsed late last week. The Big Ten Conference and Pac-12 today announcing that they have canceled its fall football season. Two major college football conferences slashing plans amid the coronavirus pandemic. Around the world, we've seen the number of COVID-19 cases surpass 20 million. Here in the U.S., it's just over 738,000 cases, with the death toll in our country now just over 164,000. The story shaping Washington today, it's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin with Campaign 2020. In this afternoon's announcement, the Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden has selected California Senator Kamala Harris to serve as his running mate. She is 55 years old. In her first term in the Senate, served as California's Attorney General. Kamala Harris is a graduate of Howard University here in Washington and the University of California Law School. Joe Biden is calling her, quote, a fearless fighter for the little guy and one of the country's finest public servants. She becomes the first female African-American on a major party ticket. And late this afternoon, we talked to David Catanese, political reporter for McClatchy Newspapers, on today's announcement.
So I think Joe Biden sort of ended where he started. I think she was long considered to be the front runner to be the vice presidential running mate. And while they went through a ton of options and I think kicked the tires on a bunch of those different potential options, she made the most sense ideologically, given that she is to the center left of the party, but not sort of in that more liberal lane, and also bringing that historic diversity to the ticket, being a black woman.
The fact that she ran for president, she faced media scrutiny over her campaign. Was that in her favor?
I think so. I mean, I talked to Democrats for months about this, and they said it's got to be someone who's been through the process, especially just given how important this election is, given that you're ahead. You don't need to take a chance. You don't need to take a big risk. You know, Biden is ahead about 8 points nationally. He's ahead in most of the key battleground states. So don't make a mistake. And the fact that Kamala Harris had been through nationally televised debates, had been through dozens and dozens of, you know, live television and cable interviews, that worked to her advantage, of course.
And of course, that is often the cardinal rule in American politics when selecting a running mate. Rule number one, do no harm.
Absolutely. And I think that was the conclusion that the Biden campaign and Joe Biden himself made. I think they were looking at different options. I mean, the fact that Susan Rice, the former national security advisor, and Karen Bass, a congresswoman from the Los Angeles area, did get serious looks over the last months. But their vulnerabilities, came to the forefront as well. And I think the one thing about Kamala Harris that she had an advantage of is a lot of her vulnerabilities had already been aired and she had defended them. That's not to say she's not going to be challenged. That's not going to be to say that, you know, there's going to be progressives that are going to be happy with it. I'm already seeing statements fill up in my inbox minutes after the announcement, from some people on the left that aren't happy about it. But no matter who you pick, you're going to get some backlash. Biden's job was to reduce that as much as possible, and I think this pick sort of does that.
We're talking with David Catanese of McClatchy Newspapers. How significant was the George Floyd death and the subsequent demonstrations across the country in this selection process? Did that change the dynamics?
I'm not sure if it changed it. I think it. I do think it made it more important and made there be more pressure to pick a black woman. You saw numerous groups even before that in June. I mean, as far back as April, you had a prominent African-American say Joe Biden needs to reflect the diversity of the party by putting not only a female on the ticket, but a black female, especially given how the African-American vote powered him through South Carolina and into Super Tuesday and saved his campaign and propelled him to the nomination. I think the George Floyd protest definitely enhanced that. And you got the sense over the last month it was going to be a black woman. You know, Amy Klobuchar taking herself out of the process months back. I think Elizabeth Warren was hurt, the fact that she's not an African-American woman. So I think the finalists that you saw, Karen Bass, Susan Rice, they were finalists in part because they were black women. And I think Kamala Harris's experience on the national stage, the fact that she had run for office successfully in California, won campaigns, and then been through the national gauntlet, I think that pushed her over the top.
What are you hearing in terms of the rollout? Obviously, the announcement today on Twitter, the convention, which is a virtual convention, is beginning in 6 days. What will happen between now and next Monday?
So it looks like there will be some type of public event. We're hearing potentially as soon as tomorrow, potentially, most likely in Delaware, where Joe Biden has been for most of the campaign. There's not going to be a big campaign tour around the country, given coronavirus and the health risks that surround that. So, you know, in a traditional environment, you'd see Biden out at the campaign trip, hitting all the big battleground states, flying into cities, flying into airport hangars. You're not going to see that this time. I think there will be some joint appearance with the ticket to sort of get that photograph, but it won't be a rally, I don't think. There won't be a lot of people involved. And I think, you know, most of the country will get their introduction to Kamala Harris next week during that big convention speech, which will be virtual, which will be online and possibly taped before.
We, of course, are just hours into this announcement, but one of the criteria that Joe Biden put forward is somebody who is going to be his own Biden, referring to his 8 years as vice president with Barack Obama. What about the chemistry between Joe Biden and Kamala Harris?
So there's a lot of speculation because she launched an attack against him in the first Democratic debate over segregationist policies. And some people thought that would have hurt her chances, you know. And I think Jill Biden even said during a fundraiser that it was a gut punch that she, you know, not directly said, but insinuated that, you know, Joe Biden was a racist, or at least supported a racist policy. Joe Biden is not one to hold grudges, though. I mean, this is a guy who wants to work with everyone, and I think he is genuine in that. You know, I think they probably had long conversations about that during the vetting process. I also think it was helpful that she was friendly with Beau, the son he lost just a few years ago. He was an attorney general when she was an attorney general. They had worked together on issues and formed a kinship. And we all know how close Joe Biden was to his son. So I do think that relationship probably helped her chances, given that was a relationship established way before she was running for president.
So today's announcement does not surprise you?
It doesn't. I mean, I think the Biden campaign did a great job of keeping some suspense throughout this process. But, you know, I think most, you know, political observers, political analysts thought Kamala Harris was the most likely person to be chosen as the running mate as far back as, you know, when the 2020 campaign started. If she wasn't the nominee herself, she was going to be one of the top contenders. I think there was some question about whether she would put her own political sort of ambitions before Biden's. That got a lot of backlash that, you know, females aren't allowed to have their own political ambitions. Of course, anyone running for president has ambitions. Obviously, that was not something that was a problem for Biden in the end regarding her loyalty. But it will be interesting, you know, as we learn more about this, what kind of questions were asked. And I'm sure we'll learn more about what exactly criteria Biden used and who exactly were in the final rounds of the selection process with Kamala Harris.
On a day with a significant development in this presidential campaign, David Catanese of McClatchy Newspapers here in Washington, we thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And some early reaction to this from the LA Times editorial, quote, in picking California Senator Kamala Harris to join the Democrats' 2020 presidential ticket, Joe Biden has shown that unlike the man currently holding the job he seeks, he is not afraid of strong women. The editorial at LATimes.com. Senator Harris tweeting the following: Joe Biden can unify the American people because he spent his life fighting for us. And as president, he will build an America that lives up to our ideals. I am honored to join him as our party's nominee for vice president and do what it takes to make him our commander-in-chief. And this statement from California House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, U.S. House Speaker, who's from California, as the U.S. Senator, as California Attorney General, and in every leadership position that she has held, Kamala Harris has advanced a more just and fair future for all. Rooted in strong values and her proud American story, Vice President Harris will be a tireless champion for hardworking families everywhere. Now we must ensure the historic election of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as President and Vice President of the United States. Well, as David Catanese mentioned, there was that very first debate moment during the presidential primary back in 2019, and this exchange between Senator Harris and former Vice President Joe Biden.
Everything I've done in my career, I ran because of civil rights. I continue to think we have to make fundamental changes in civil rights. And those civil rights, by the way, include not just only African-Americans, but the LGBT community.
But Vice President Biden, do you agree today that you were wrong to oppose busing in America then?
No,
do you agree?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education. That's what I opposed.
Well,
I
there
did
was
not
a failure of states to integrate public schools in America. I was part of the second class to integrate Berkeley, California public schools almost two decades after Brown v. Board of Education.
Because your city council made that decision. It was a
local
decision.
So that's where the federal government must step in. That's why we have the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. That's why we need to pass the Equality Act.
A debate moment during the 2020 Democratic presidential primary last year, a moment that will continue to be played in the days ahead. And the Trump campaign with this statement. I'll read it to you in its entirety. Quote, not long ago, Kamala Harris called Joe Biden a racist and asked for an apology she never received. Clearly, phony Kamala will abandon her own morals as well as try to bury her record as a prosecutor in order to appease the anti-police extremists controlling the Democrat Party. In her failed attempt at running for president, Kamala Harris gleefully embraced the left's radical manifesto, calling for trillions of dollars in new taxes and backing Bernie Sanders' government takeover of health care. She is proof that Joe Biden is an empty shell being filled with the extreme agenda of the radicals on the left. The Trump statement goes on to read as follows: Joe Biden is no moderate, and with Harris as his political living will, he is surrendering control of our nation to the radical mob with promises to raise taxes, cut police funding, kill energy jobs, open our borders, and appease socialist dictators. At the ballot box, Americans will resoundingly reject the abysmal failures of Biden-Harris in favor of the America First strength of President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence. That statement issued after the announcement that Kamala Harris is Joe Biden's running mate. In other news tonight, in campaign 2020, during an interview with radio talk show host Hugh Hewitt, the president saying George Washington would have had a hard time beating him before the coronavirus pandemic had hit. According to Real Clear Politics, the polling average, the president's approval rating in late March was hovering around 47%. Today, it is closer to 43%. The president was also asked about the Supreme Court, an issue in this election. If there is a vacancy before the end of his first term, what would he do? More with President Trump and Hugh Hewitt.
You mean if something happened like now?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'd do it. Sure. It depends.
If someone in mind?
You know, I don't know what you're talking about, Tim, but if you're talking about if something would happen now, no, I would move quickly. Why not? I mean, they would. The Democrats would if they were in this position. But
do you have someone in mind?
At the end of my term, I'll be up to about 300, could be even a little more, 300 federal judges, including Court of Appeals appellate divisions, will be at 300. Think of that. 300 judges, probably a little bit more, and two Supreme Court judges. Think of that. It's not happened. You know,
no, you followed through. The 53 appeals court judges are all solid, and I hope
and
you keep making them.
And the appeals court judges are, you know, I'm getting rave reviews, and even some of the those on the left are saying, well, we don't agree with them, but they are very powerful picks. So we're getting rave reviews on judges, I will say that. But, you know, who's had so many? Now, I was given a gift because I had 142 when I first came in. I said, you know, I've always heard, and you've always said, and I've always heard the most important thing you can do are Supreme Court justices and judges. You know, combination, really, both. And I said, how many do I have my first day? Sir, you have 142. I said, you got to be kidding. So I started off with 142. Most presidents start off with none. I would say very rarely do you have one. I had 142, got them filled with really talented, very, very great people, very highly respected people. And from there, I've gone on to continue to fill a lot of judgeships. A lot of people have retired because they got to a certain age and they retired. We didn't discourage that. And we will be over 300. It's hard to believe, but we'll be over 300.
It's a great achievement. If there is a vacancy this year or early next year or any time in your second term, do you have a choice already in mind to nominate?
I do. I have somebody that I think would be excellent.
That's with the Hewitt Program and President Donald Trump. Well, Vice President Mike Pence on the campaign trail. He was in Tucson, Arizona, focusing on law enforcement and religious issues. Here's a portion of what he said.
But as I said, in these challenging times, none have done more to save American lives than our heroic healthcare workers, first responders, and the men and women of law enforcement here in Arizona and across the country. It's true. You stepped into harm's way, often without regard to your personal safety. You rendered assistance. You got people of the communities all across this state to the care that any one of us would want a family member to have. You stood in the gap in the midst of a pandemic, and for that, you have the thanks and the admiration of the American people. That's why it's amazing to think that in the wake of all that heroism, even the heroism of these recent days, that some of the leading politicians in the Democratic Party today liken law enforcement officers to stormtroopers. Joe Biden said not long ago that well-armed police become, in his words, the enemy when confronting lawlessness in our streets. Well, I want to assure you that your president, your vice president, and the overwhelming majority of the American people know that the men and women of law enforcement are the best people in this country. Law enforcement isn't the problem. Law enforcement is the solution.
Arizona has become a battleground state in this presidential campaign. That was Vice President Mike Pence in Tucson, Arizona. Also on the campaign trail and through the airwaves, some new ads now on the air, including this new spot from the Trump campaign taking aim at Joe Biden.
Biden says,
if you elect me, your taxes are going to be raised, not cut.
That means middle-class families, small businesses, and seniors pay higher taxes. It's the biggest tax increase in history.
Citizenship for 11 million undocumented folks.
That means 11 million illegal immigrants competing for American jobs, eligible for free health care, Social Security, and Medicare. America can't afford Joe Biden.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
And the Biden campaign also out with a series of new ads, including this one.
The story of Black America is the story of America. It's the story of a people who have pushed this country to live up to its stated ideals. But Black people have always believed in the promise of a better America. So, at this moment we're in now, we must choose to fight for that better America. And just like our ancestors, who stood up to the violent racists of a generation ago, we will stand up to this president and say, no more. Because America is better than him. So we choose to be bigger. We choose to be bolder. We choose to bring back justice, respect, and dignity to this country. We choose Joe Biden to lead us all towards that American promise together.
That from the Biden campaign on the day in which he has selected Kamala Harris as his running mate. And another op-ed from the San Francisco Chronicle saying, as a barrier-breaking former California Attorney General and San Francisco DA, Kamala Harris giving the Democratic presidential nominee to be a candidate with long experience in executive and legislative roles, as well as prosecutorial sharpness that she brought with her to the Senate. But Harris has also been opposed by some progressives for her record in law enforcement and at times less liberal positions. Her nearly 20 years in office in San Francisco, Sacramento, and in Washington, D.C., along with her criticisms of Biden during the presidential primary, could also provide fodder for attacks from President Trump and other Republicans. That from the San Francisco Chronicle website. In other news today, Russia today claiming to be the first country to approve a coronavirus vaccine. The Associated Press reports it is a move that was met with international skepticism and unease because the shots have only been studied in dozens of people. Nevertheless, President Vladimir Putin announcing that the health ministry's approval, saying that one of his two adult daughters already was inoculated. He said the vaccine underwent the necessary testing and was shown to provide lasting immunity to the coronavirus, although Russian authorities have offered no proof to back up their claims of safety or effectiveness. That country's health ministry saying in a statement that the vaccine is expected to provide immunity from the coronavirus vaccine for up to 2 years, citing its experience with vaccines made from similar technology. Scientists around the world, though, have been cautioning that even if the vaccine candidates are proven to work, it will take more time and testing to see how long the protection would even last. Well, the Center for Strategic and International Studies writes the following, quote, "The global scramble for COVID-19 vaccines is a historic enterprise, unprecedented in its breadth, scale, and speed." At an event sponsored by CSIS, Margaret Hamburg weighing in on the debate. She served as the FDA commissioner during the first 4 years of the Obama administration.
Well, certainly treaties are not easy to undertake, but one could even imagine in the process of trying to think about what might be in a treaty, you could make a lot of important progress forward in sort of laying out all the different issues, you know, many of which you just touched on, that can become barriers to effective collaboration. And I think that it would be unlikely that in the current state of politics in this country and probably many other that we could really forge such a treaty. Right. But as an exercise, I could see it would have real value. And getting away also from this either or mentality, these sort of false dichotomies, because the U.S. can pursue efforts to get vaccine for use in our own country, but also participate in international collaborative efforts like COVAX. And in fact, it's a sensible strategy, as was touched on already, because it allows you to distribute your risk, and it allows you to diversify your portfolio, so to speak, because we don't know, which vaccine is gonna make it over the finish line, hopefully more than one. But it is really a critical time.
Meanwhile, the New Republic posting a story with this headline, "Can platform vaccines really save us?" There are lessons from past pandemics, and this approach is something NIH is striving for. We talked to the author of the piece, Melody Schreiber. She's a contributing writer for the New Republic. And on a separate note, she's out with a new book this November titled "What We Didn't Expect: Personal Stories About Premature Birth." I asked her to explain the idea of platform vaccines, what it means for researchers during this COVID-19 pandemic.
Vaccines are kind of like vehicles that can be customized. So essentially you build everything that it would have in common with any vaccine you would need, this delivery platform essentially. And all you need to do is sequence a virus and you just pop it right onto the platform, kind of work it a little bit, and then you're ready to go. That's the idea behind it.
What did the experts like Dr. Anthony Fauci say about this?
So Dr. Anthony Fauci has said that this could be a potential game changer for working with infectious disease pandemics because of the ability to move so quickly. The problem here is that very few of these vaccines have even made it to human trials, and even fewer, of course, have been approved for use.
In your story, which is available at newrepublic.com, you say that as a country, we got lucky in 2009 with the swine flu pandemic. What's different about that compared to what we're dealing with today with coronavirus?
Well, first of all, we already have flu vaccines approved for use in humans, and we have ways to update them very quickly. And so that's what we did back in 2009. We had a vaccine ready to go in 6 months, which is really fast. Even so, that wasn't fast enough because kids came back to school about a month before the vaccine was ready and the pandemic took off.
Is there such a thing as a universal vaccine for these types of viruses?
Well, there's not yet, but that's kind of Dr. Fauci's dream and the dream of many vaccine makers and virologists. The idea of a universal vaccine would be it doesn't matter what variant of SARS-CoV-2 or CoV-2, you know, whatever number you have, if you have a universal coronavirus vaccine, you just get that one and then you're protected. The virologists and vaccine makers have been trying to find one for influenza for many years. Flu is a very tricky one. It's a very difficult virus to vaccinate against. Coronaviruses are, it seems like a little bit easier, but, you know, they're trying very quickly to catch up given the pandemic.
Bottom line, what's the potential for platform vaccines and what has to happen next, both for pharmaceutical companies, for NIH, for the federal government and other entities?
Well, the potential for platform vaccines is vast. If they actually work, I mean, this could be a game changer for how we address pandemics before they really get started. The challenge is we don't really know yet how well they work, if they work at all. And what we really need to do is be focusing on these human trials and not allowing politics or any outside interest to speed up the important work that vaccine makers and that regulatory agencies are doing right now to make sure that the vaccines work, first of all, and that they're safe and effective. And one important part about making sure that they actually work is if you give this to people and they believe that they're protected and they're not, then we could have even more death and illness than we saw without a vaccine.
Melanie Schreiber, she is a contributor for The New Republic here in Washington. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio, also available as a podcast for Tuesday, August the 11th. At the White House, the president's economic advisor was asked about that executive order signed over the weekend by the president in New Jersey and exactly what it means for those Americans now out of work, many who have lost that additional $600 a week in assistance at the end of July. Here's more with Larry Kudlow.
So let's go through this. The state unemployment baseline, right, is a median of $400 per person per week. We made some technical changes, some small technical changes in our EO. So any state who has already been given at least $100 in benefits now qualifies, okay? They don't have to engage in cost sharing. If they choose to, they can add. If that's up to them. But if, and I'm going to just guess every single state gave at least $100. You know, in the big states, much, much more than that. So the average is the median is 400. So we will put in to all those states who qualify, which I think will be 50 states, $300 of federal benefits. So that equals $700 per person per week.
If the state is already doing at least 100.
That's correct. And
so
I just.
Out a new mechanism for this?
We just felt we'd make it an easier way.
So when do you think checks will start going out?
Look, Labor Department's thinking 2 weeks. So it's going to be effective August 1. So there'll be a little couple weeks back. And that's what they're saying. And, you know, I understand people are asking the question, but Secretary Scalia over there had worked with the states very, very closely to update all their systems and upgrade their systems with CARES 1, which, as you know, is 400 plus 600. So I think they're in better shape. Now, he has put out some memos to the states, and he and his team are on the phone working with them. So I think this is very, very doable.
Larry, so really works out, though, doesn't it, to a $300 benefit, not a $400 benefit, in additional federal
support? Yes, yes. And we felt that was a good, generous compromise.
From the White House earlier today, the president's economic advisor, Larry Kudlow. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, still no movement regarding any new stimulus bill, just more finger-pointing. The Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, blaming the Democrats for stalling negotiations. Talks broke down on Friday. Here is the Republican leader.
Democrats say nobody should get any more help unless the federal government sends out jobless benefits that pay more than what people made working. Republicans support extending a federal supplement for unemployment. Make no mistake about that. But we share the view of Democrats like the House Democratic Majority Leader, the senior senator from Maryland, the Democratic governor of Connecticut, all of whom indicated it should be doable to land somewhere smarter than a flat $600. This is not complicated, Mr. President. Both sides want to help unemployed people. Republicans never wanted the federal benefit to lapse to zero and tried to extend the money. But as our economy tries to reopen, there's no reason Uncle Sam should take taxes out of essential workers' paychecks to pay other people more to stay home. This is just a flavor of the Democratic demands. The two parties should have been able to agree on a huge sweep of subjects, from testing to school money, to legal protection, to direct payments, and more. Republicans wanted to reach an agreement everywhere we could and then continue to fight over the contested questions later. Democrats said no because they know their unrelated wish list items would have no prayer of standing on their own merit. Only these hostage tactics could possibly get their bad ideas across the finish line.
That's Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, and he was also on Fox News. This headline at foxnews.com: Senator McConnell wants the blue state bailouts off the table in the coronavirus aid talks. More from the Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York.
We have over 5 million confirmed cases of COVID-19. It just took 17 days to go from 4 million Americans with COVID to 5 million. Unemployment is higher than it ever was during the Great Recession. More than 150,000 Americans have died. Small businesses every day are closing, and those that are still open are struggling. Families can't afford to feed their children. Americans can't pay the rent and will be thrown out of their homes. Millions are out of work, and many more worry that they will be out of work in the month or two to come. This is a huge crisis. In this time of national emergency, Democrats believe we must focus on the health and economic security of the American people. If we don't address the health crisis, nothing else will matter. But we have to focus on economic security as well. We have to keep Americans in their homes, put food on the table, prevent them from slipping into further hardship and poverty. That's what animated Democrats to develop a $3.4 trillion plan to finally crush the virus and rescue American families. It was based on the needs of our country, both health and economic, the needs of our schools and businesses and workers and our healthcare system. We Democrats tell America, we have your back. Unfortunately, our Republican friends do not.
That from the Senate floor earlier today, Senator Chuck Schumer, and we carry the Senate live on C-SPAN 2. Well, as Congress looks at another round of stimulus carrying a price tag well into the trillions of dollars, the nation's debt continues to grow. It is now over $26 trillion. In just a moment, we'll talk to the executive director of the Concord Coalition. When that organization was formed with a single goal of reducing the nation's red ink, one of its co-founders explained the mission. Pete Peterson served as Commerce Secretary during the Nixon administration in New York in 1992. With the debt clock in the background, he had this to say.
We heard a lot about supply side not too many years ago. Supply side was supposed to have meant more investment capital. But all we've done is to turn into a demand-side economy in which we're essentially running amok. So when I look at that debt clock, what I see, Paul, is a debt cancer that is metastasizing throughout our entire economy and our society. And if we don't revise and stop that clock from going soon, we're going to reduce our ability to innovate, to compete, and to improve the living standards of ourselves and our children.
That from Pete Peterson back in 1992, one of the co-founders of the Concord Coalition, and his reference to Paul is former Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas. And joining us on the phone is Robert Bixby. He is the executive director of the Concord Coalition. That was 1992. Now it's 2020, and the debt seems to be exploding.
Yeah, it's gone up by about $20 trillion since then.
So now looking at $26 trillion and growing, on your website, you give a projection that things are going to look pretty dire by the middle of this century. Can you explain?
Well, and by the way, I should note that that really doesn't account for the big run-up that we're likely to have as a result of the pandemic. But the budget had a pre-existing condition, you might say, which was fiscal unsustainability. And that's because our estimated expenditures were growing faster than revenues on a pace that made the debt automatically grow every year. And then you add in added interest costs, because if you've ever tried to live off your credit cards by making the minimal payments, you know that the interest begins to add up. So the budget has a built-in dynamic, and still has it, by the way, that makes the debt grow at an unsustainable rate over the long term. That was pre-existing before the pandemic. It has nothing to do about with what Congress has been spending in response to the pandemic.
Because, as you well know, Congress is now looking minimum $1 trillion. That's the Republican plan. Democrats want to spend upwards of $3 trillion, which would move the nation's debt to close to $30 trillion in the next year or two.
Yeah, and, you know, here's the thing about failure to prepare. I mean, one of the reasons you want to have a sustainable fiscal policy, you want to, you know, have a in good times you should be paying down your debt and or at least stabilizing the debt. We weren't doing that. The debt was rising, the deficits were rising, even though we had this record-long economy. So what happens is an emergency comes along where you have to spend money, and the debt balloons even more. And that's what's happening now. I mean, the Concord Coalition is not opposed to deficit spending in response to the emergency. And in this case, it does require a great deal of money. This is a very unique situation where, in response to a health care crisis, the decision was made to shut down the economy, basically. And so lots of people are out of work because of that, and the government has an obligation to do what it can to provide assistance both to the individuals and to the businesses that are affected.
So when Congress and the country gets beyond this pandemic, what has to happen next?
Well, we have to get back on this track of trying to get back on a track of fiscal sustainability. We're going to be doing that from a much higher level of debt. But let's say that this is like responding to a war or something, and it's a big but one-time expenditure. What we then need to do is say, okay, we got to look at the underlying structural problem that we already had before, the pre-existing condition, and try to make sure that, emergency aside, we have a spending and revenue track that match each other rather than just running a perpetual debt. And so that's going to require some difficult choices.
I don't want to oversimplify this, but bottom line, does it mean raising taxes and cutting federal spending?
Well, I believe it means both of those. And, you know, before anybody freaks out, not right now, not while we're responding to the pandemic. But, you know, if you have a situation where your underlying budget is you're spending more than you're taking in, and that grows, not just stays stable, but grows over time as sort of a permanent, structurally growing deficit, those are your options. I mean, you can't grow your way out of it, you know, by growing the economy, which you should do. I mean, we should do that. But yeah, I mean, it's those are the choices: cut spending, raise taxes.
Robert Bixby, he is the executive director of the Concord Coalition here in Washington. We thank you for your time.
Thanks, Steve.
On Wall Street, the arrows were down. The Dow off by 104 points at the closing bell. The S&P losing 26, and the NASDAQ fell 185. Back to our top campaign story, Senator Kamala Harris joining Joe Biden as the 2020 ticket, the convention getting underway next week, and the Trump campaign already out with this response to the Harris selection.
Kamala Harris ran for president by rushing to the radical left, embracing Bernie's plan for socialized medicine, calling for trillions in new taxes, attacking Joe Biden for racist policies. Voters rejected Harris. They smartly spotted a phony. But not Joe Biden. He's not that smart. Biden calls himself a transition candidate. He is handing over the reins to Kamala while they jointly embrace the radical left. Slow Joe and phony Kamala. Perfect together. Wrong for America.
That ad released just moments ago from the Trump campaign. Senator Harris, of course, does make history as the first African-American female on a major party ticket. She ran for president herself, and here is a portion of her announcement from Oakland, California, early last year.
It's up to us. It's up to us. Each and every one of us. So let's remember, in this fight, we have the power of the people. We can achieve the dreams of our parents and grandparents. We can heal our nation. We can give our children the future they deserve. We can reclaim the American dream for every single person in our country. And we can restore America's moral leadership on this planet. So, let's do this.
And that from Senator Kamala Harris. She withdrew from the race in December of last year, and now she is on the ticket with Joe Biden. The two will have a joint appearance tomorrow in Delaware. We'll have live coverage on the C-SPAN networks, and you can continue to follow our campaign coverage on the web at cspan.org. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast wherever you get your favorite podcast, but also on our website, cspan.org/podcasts. On a very busy Tuesday, I'm Steve Scully in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your evening.